It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie. I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervie & Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And unfortunately, Carrie Kasem is not here, despite what you just heard. She is not sitting across from me as she usually is, as she is helping with disaster relief in Florida because of Hurricane Michael. So she spent the week there doing yeoman's duties, helping people. She says it's one of the worst disasters she's ever seen. She has gone on 5 different disaster release efforts, and she said this is horrible. So she's told me that if I get a chance, tell everyone to try and donate, try and give money, try and give whatever they can to help out everyone struggling after Hurricane Michael. So, Carrie, we're hoping you'll be back next week. And thanks for all that wonderful work you're doing on behalf of Gervie's Law and everyone in general. I know it's been a tough week. Anyway, we will proceed without Carrie Kasem. I think I can do it. I think I can. I think I can. I think that's what the little engine that could said. I read that book to my little son and daughter, and they love it. We're trying to instill in them this persistence and keep at it-ness, and hopefully we can do it. We have a great show for you today. I'm flying solo. Later in the show, we're going to have Mary Holland on the show. She's the director of the Graduate Legal Skills Program at NYU School of Law, and she is going to be talking about vaccines and her new book, The HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. The HPV vaccine, so controversial. Mary has a lot to say about it. We're also going to talk about California Senate Bill 277 and the vaccinations for kids in school, which is of particular interest for me because my kid just started kindergarten and had to make sure that all the vaccines were in order for him to go to school. So we're going to talk to her about that a little later in the show. But first, we're going to welcome to Gervie's Law Scott Anderson. And Scott Anderson is the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute. He's also senior editor at Lawfare. And we're going to talk to Scott about a subject that's all over the airwaves, all over the media. Anywhere you look, you hear about the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. It really shocked the world because of the grisly details of the death. And because it occurred in a consulate, which we thought enjoyed special protections under international law, but we will find out. First of all, I want to welcome you to Gervie's Law, Scott Anderson.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, this topic has just been so upsetting to so many people. You've done a lot of work in it. You're an expert in national security law, national security policy. First of all, I want to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Tell us your understanding of what happened to Jamal Khashoggi.
Well, you know, there's a question between what we know and what we suspect.
Right.
What we know happened at this point is that he arrived on October 2nd to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, with his fiance. He entered around 1:14 p.m., I believe, and he never exited. His fiance waited outside until late into the evening for him, but he was never seen alive again.
Do we know why his fiance wasn't allowed to go in with him? Weren't they trying to arrange this marriage thing and she was kept outside?
I'm not aware of her having been kept outside. My understanding is that she did not go in, but I actually am not certain about that. But my understanding is that she voluntarily did not go in, that he went in by himself.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong about that. I actually am not 100% positive. Well, regardless of the reason, she ended up waiting outside while he went in individually. She later wrote in an op-ed, I believe for the Washington Post, that they were aware that there was a risk that the Saudi government was trying to return him to Saudi Arabia, but that he didn't think they would be daring enough to take action like this, you know, in a foreign consulate, in a foreign property, within another government such as Turkey.
And tell us why, before you go on, Scott, tell us why there was some concern for his well-being. What did he publish? What did he say that perhaps didn't sit well with the Saudi royalty?
So Jamal Khashoggi is a very well-known editor and journalist for many years in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia in particular. And the last few years, he has really become more critical of aspects of Saudi governance and foreign policy, and particularly those aspects that are being driven by Mohammed bin Salman, who is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, and has kind of for the last 2 or 3 years played a very strong guiding role in establishing the policy of Saudi Arabia, particularly since his father became king.
Right.
In this capacity, you know, he's ended up leaving Saudi Arabia, moving to the United States, becoming a columnist for the Washington Post, and wrote several op-eds that were critical of various types of Mohammed bin Salman, often called MBS, and I'll call him that, MBS's policies.
As long as you just don't call him BS, MBS.
Exactly, MBS. And it's particularly problematic because Khashoggi spoke with a lot of credibility. He was somebody who was associated with the royal family for a long time. He was not an open critic of, you know, the royal family or as an institution. He was really criticizing the specific policies being undertaken by this government, particularly by this official or strongly linked with this official.
Right.
And therefore, it carried a lot of weight more than other critics would have.
So tell us again, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's just such an intriguing story. And I want to make sure all the listeners have a good background, and you're giving a great background for us. Tell us your understanding. And I really appreciate the fact that you've differentiated between what we know happened and what we may surmise or what people are guessing, what the hypothesis is. But he was in there, never came out.
Exactly. What we understand from Turkish prosecutors, information that was originally leaked by Turkish officials through the press, now has been more or less confirmed in most details by Turkish authorities, is that they suspect he was killed shortly after entering. He may or may not have been tortured or interrogated for a brief period. And then, according to several of these accounts, his body was then dismembered. This was done by a group of individuals who had traveled to Istanbul from Saudi Arabia early that morning. And several Turkish newspapers and media outlets have released photographs of these individuals, as well as travel records indicating that they flew from Saudi Arabia on a private plane that morning, checked into hotels before traveling to the consulate. Some of those individuals were then seen leaving the consulate a few hours later after Khashoggi's disappearance in a pair of consulate vehicles and driving to the consul general's house, the consul general being the kind of chief head of the consulate.
Is this something that you learn after the fact, or was there talk about what was going on during the time that he was actually killed?
Came out really the next day or two or a few days afterwards as his disappearance was being investigated. It seems like some Turkish authorities may have stepped into investigate fairly early. Mm-hmm. Those individuals later left on a flight that evening, at least according to some media reports, although I haven't seen it in all. Some Turkish authorities searched their plane or part of their plane when they were leaving, looking for Khashoggi to find him. But most of these details have been come out and they've been leaked really to the Turkish media, probably at the direction of the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has a close relationship with a lot of these media outlets and has a kind of reputation and past pattern of using leaks like this to kind of help shape a public narrative.
He seems to be in the news more than he probably should be.
Well, it's certainly in some ways. Here he's played this situation fairly savvily, I would say.
Yeah. So when we talk about what occurred in there, we have to kind of think, I guess the question, the elephant in the room is, does the Crown Prince, MBS, have knowledge? Is this something that he did? Should he be held accountable for the, how many were there, about 15 of the guys who showed up and
Correct. And
left?
Correct. There's about 15 individuals ultimately arrived in two different flights over the course of the day and then left the country over the course of the day as well. We don't know. I mean, that is the big outstanding question, is exactly where the order came from. Initially, the Saudi government denied that anything like this had happened. They said Khashoggi had, in fact, left. Later, some tapes revealed that one of the members of the team may have tried to pose as Khashoggi leaving the consulate in a kind of unpersuasive video sequence. The Saudis then kind of changed their narrative to say, well, we may have confronted him. There may have been a brawl that he may have started. They seem to now be conceding that he is dead. To some extent, perhaps even conceding that this was the product of a plan by someone, but they have not yet conceded that this was a plan or an operation that was conceived of and approved of at a very senior political level. They claim to have canned five different Saudi officials in different decision-making capacities, but no step has been taken kind of within the royal court. And this is the kind of point of contention with Erdogan and Turkish authorities. They have said, by all appearances, this really was something that was authorized by senior officials, and we need to see some responsibility and culpability for that.
Do you think that it's just too big of an event for it not to be on the radar of these senior officials or of the royalty, the crown prince?
I find that to be difficult to believe. It's not impossible. But here you see an operation where 15 people were involved, all of whom were government officials. I think the most telling thing particularly is that the consul general was involved. This is the senior diplomat involved in managing the consulate. He's not somebody who's, sitting in Riyadh with this other group of individuals dreaming up these sorts of operations. They were somehow able to arrive in Istanbul the same day.
Yeah.
And then secure his cooperation. He also reportedly, to several media accounts, sent all the non-Saudi employees home that day, told them not to report to work the day of this meeting, along with also his household staff later in the day. So that kind of participation by, kind of official representatives by the government, I have trouble believing that that would be spontaneous. It doesn't mean it's absolutely impossible. It's not. It's hard to rule that out with what we know, but it seems extremely unlikely.
Scott, I don't think you're the only one who has trouble believing it. So you're not in the minority. We have to take a quick break, but after the break, I want to address some of the issues in the case, the jurisdiction in the case, diplomatic immunity. Want to talk about the impact that this has on the area and the stability of the area. There's so much that the implications of this killing has on the world, Middle East in particular. And we'll talk about that after the break. We're talking to Scott Anderson, who is the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings Institute. And we will be right back. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
ABC News Fire Update, I'm Jason Campadonia. The Woolsey Fire continues to rage in the Thousand Oaks and Malibu area. The entire city of Malibu is under mandatory evacuation orders. This man watched his home burn to the ground.
Thought we were safe because the storm had blown through, the wind was going the other way. But then what happened, the wind shifted, and then the embers came over in this canyon, which hasn't burned for about 75 years at least.
He says when the Woolsey Fire got into his neighborhood, it was simply a wall of orange.
It's unstoppable. It's unstoppable. It's just flames. It could not. These guys, the fire department can't stop it. It is just beyond control.
The fire is estimated to be at around 70,000 acres. Over 200,000 people have been evacuated. 30,000 homes are being threatened. The power company is now in the area shutting off the power to keep firefighters safe as they come across downed power lines. Updates at top and bottom. Bulletins at once. 790 KABC.
Wendy's knows when it comes to fries, the more the better. Because people just can't get enough of their favorite hamburger sidekick. So for a limited time, Wendy's is giving you any size fry for just a dollar. That's a small, medium, even a large order of natural cut sea salted goodness for just a buck. Any size you like for the same little price. But a deal this good won't last long. So get any size fry for $1 from Wendy's today.
At participating Wendy's for a limited time, a la carte only, excludes top fries. Price and participation may vary in Alaska and Hawaii.
Wherever you are this giving season, there's no better way to say happy holidays than with custom cards, calendars, and photo gifts from Vistaprint. And right now, you can get 50% off all holiday cards and calendars at Vistaprint.com. There are hundreds of our newest card designs to choose from. Or give a year's worth of joy by personalizing calendars full of unforgettable pictures. So get merry, get jolly, get 50% off all holiday cards and calendars. Plus, save on other photo gifts at Vistaprint.com. Just enter promo code HOLIDAY. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code HOLIDAY.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Welcome back to Gervey's Law, lifting Murphy's Law to the highest level on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. And Carrie isn't here with me today. She is on assignment. I like to say it. Gervey's Law sent her to Florida to clean up after the hurricane, so she's doing some great work. It's the assignment I send her on. Actually, she should be here. Hopefully next week she will be, but I'm glad that she's contributing in a very big way. We're talking to Scott Anderson, who is David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Government Studies at Brookings. He's also Senior Editor, Lawfare. Now, Scott, before we start talking again about Jamal Khashoggi and some of the legal issues in the case, you've just been at Brookings for a rather short while. How are you enjoying the work there?
It's phenomenal. You know, it's a phenomenal environment and institution with incredible, brilliant colleagues and who are really intent on kind of digging into questions of policy that are facing our country and the world and trying to find good solutions. So personally, it's, you know, kind of my dream job and the dream place to do it. So I can't complain.
I can imagine it would be. You know, interestingly, I read somewhere where you talked about a book that had an influence on you, Moral Man and Immoral Society. Doesn't that have some implications on what you're doing at Brookings?
You know, I suppose it does in certain ways. It's a book by Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a kind of Christian theologian in the early 20th century. And he was very involved in issues, questions of war and ethics and politics and how they intersected, and really had an idea about how human beings relate to political institutions such as the state and how conceptions of morality that we may think of something as immoral for an individual to do, but moral for a state to do. And those sorts of questions certainly come up in areas of international law and policy, which is where I operate.
I think not only in international law and policy, but also domestically, a lot of people have been forced to look at those questions and issues. And it's probably a good read for people who have a lot of trouble trying to figure out the Trump administration and President Trump in particular, and the policies that they may find to be the best policies for the country, notwithstanding maybe the way that they're presented by the president is not something that they would approve of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to also just mention Lawfare, because you're senior editor at Lawfare. Tell us a little bit about that.
Lawfare is, you know, an online publication where we really try and dig into what we call hard national security choices. It focuses on questions of kind of law and policy in a variety of different arenas. We've been in operation for 10 years now, just shy of 10 years, I should say, but getting closer. You know, bring in a lot of different practitioners and people who have a lot of real experience dealing with national security issues and related legal issues from within government, from outside of government, from a variety of places. So it's a great place to check in and learn about national security law and related issues on a daily basis. You know, we have new pieces up almost every day, not always on weekends, but certainly every day during the week at lawfareblog.com.
And a lot of times when we're looking at blogging or we're just watching TV or listening to radio, we hear political perspectives. Are you going to hear that at Lawfare?
You know, I think people, writers come bring in with their own perspectives, certainly. You know, really, we focus on national security issues, and so the political angle on those tends to be a little more limited. But writers come in with all sorts of perspectives. The one thing we are serious about is getting a variety of perspectives. That we think things are reasoned and make an effort to make an argument and support that argument, you know, I think that that's certainly the case. And we have different writers and contributors from all sorts of different perspectives on a variety of different issues.
Well, that's probably the way that it should be. And often, though, somehow we seem to steer away from that, especially when it becomes an emotional issue. Speaking of emotional issues, let's get back to the Jamal Khashoggi case. I want to talk a little bit about jurisdiction because the killing takes place in Turkey, consulate. Is it Saudi Arabia or Turkey, or what are we looking at when we're looking at justice?
Yeah, absolutely. There's this kind of widespread myth out there that an embassy or a consulate in this case is the sovereign territory of the country that sends it to. So if you were to go to Washington, D.C. and go to the British embassy here, you'd be stepping onto UK territory somehow. That's not true. That's a myth. Legally, everything that happens on that territory is still part of the host country. And that means that in this case, it's still primarily Turkey's responsibility to investigate and prosecute and take various actions for any crimes in violation of its domestic laws that may have occurred there. What does happen is that those facilities are entitled to certain legal protections as a matter of international law arising from treaties, specifically two treaties concluded in the early 1960s, the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations and the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. And what these protections are intended to do is to ensure that different countries' foreign diplomats and consular officials don't face interference or harassment from their host governments and countries when they're operating overseas. They are kind of the codification, the treaties were, of practices that had evolved over, you know, the last 200 years, really, since the 19th century, and that are heavily relied upon by almost every country in their foreign relations. And so they're taken very seriously, and countries are held to a pretty high standard for abiding by them, even in difficult situations like this, where they also cause complications for investigating serious crimes.
So what are we looking at under these circumstances? Because there seems to be an internal conflict, given what you've just said. Are the suspects going to potentially enjoy diplomatic immunity, given there's a certain, obviously, a reason for that policy? But I think, I dare say that people would be rather shocked to see the diplomatic immunity, especially given the fact that it took place on Turkish soil.
Yeah, so in this case, it's a little bit of a different regime than a lot of people probably think, in that this having taken place at a consulate, the consulate and the people who work there only receive protections that are of a lower level than what you would get at, say, an embassy or with diplomatic personnel. And those lower level protections are under the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. Now, what they say essentially is that the consulate building itself, the offices where they do all their official work, are what's called inviolable. It means that Turkish authorities can't march in like they can with, you know, other buildings with a search warrant or not, whatever the domestic law requires. They have to get the permission of Saudi Arabia. But really, that building, oh, and I should say that the same also applies for official vehicles. That's the extent of the kind of premises immunities. There's nothing to stop Turkish authorities from searching the consul general's house, which is not receive immunities. That would be different if you were the ambassador. The ambassador's homes do receive immunities, but that's not the case here. And there's also nothing to stop them from interrogating a variety of consulate personnel. Consulate personnel, including the consul general, do often get immunity from criminal jurisdiction, but there's an exception to that for grave crimes, and something along these lines is about as grave a crime as you can get. It's hard to imagine that that wouldn't extend here. The same goes for a variety of other personnel who might be called upon to give testimony. They can't be compelled to give testimony regarding their official duties or official acts, but this sort of activity, it's hard to square with what their official duties are supposed to be if they are consular personnel, which is, you know, representing national interests and helping, you know, Saudi citizens navigate various types of issues in the country. And so the issues of the immunities are, frankly, they're less lower level than most people seem to be assuming. And to some extent, also the Turkish government, even the Turkish government early on, particularly, really took a kind of careful approach to their investigation here and didn't go up to the legal limits of what they're allowed to do. Instead, they tried to coordinate with Saudi Arabia, which I take to be a sign that they were worried about some of the regional dynamics that might arise if they were to push the envelope, even if they're legally entitled to do so, in, you know, marching into the consul general's house, digging up his garden, looking for the body, some of these other proposals people have made. I suspect these limited immunities are also why the consul general left the country as the investigation was ongoing after a few days there. The same goes for the other 15 individuals who left the country. None of them would be entitled to any legal protection whatsoever, as far as I can tell, unless they were somehow categorized as diplomatic or consular personnel, which I think would be very hard to see that being credible or something that could be sustained under scrutiny.
But in this case, isn't it a matter of you snooze, you lose? Because you think of the delays, as you said, the careful approach, so to speak, maybe that's giving too much credit to the Turkish investigators. But this careful approach, you lose a lot of opportunity to gather the evidence that you need, especially when you're talking about a body and all the theories of what happened to the body and the 15 suspects. How can you recreate it when the time has passed?
Yeah, no, that's the difficulty they're facing here, exactly, is that the Turkish authorities, they've kind of criticized the Saudis. They said, well, you sent in people to participate in this investigation who then were, in fact, kind of trying to cover up parts of this fact. But that's been in the leaks to the media, that's been in some public comments. The official line is that they're still coordinating and trying to coordinate this investigation. I suspect part of the reason the Turks may be more willing to let this take place and still speak very confidently about what happened is that, according to many media reports, they appear to have an audio recording of what happened to Khashoggi, something that they appeared to have picked up in the course of their own covert surveillance.
Was that from an iPhone or something?
That was one theory. That was
or iWatch or something.
From his Apple Watch.
Apple Watch,
I believe that's been debunked, but I could be wrong. The kind of prevailing theory, as I understand it, is that this was the result of some sort of electronic surveillance that Saudi intelligence agencies were running on the consulate. They picked this up, and they've now shared this with intelligence agencies for other governments who have an interest, and that they think, you know, this is a pretty compelling audio evidence about what happened. The problem is it's very hard for them to release publicly, if not impossible, because doing so would reveal the methods by which they are or may be conducting similar surveillance of other consular facilities. And it would reveal that they were, in fact, surveilling these facilities, which raises its own kind of international law questions.
So and what about the suspects, Scott? Are they now under house arrest, or are they being held somewhere? Or what is going on? Because I know Mr. Khashoggi's sons have been very vocal about justice, and they want the body back, and they want to be able to have some closure. What's going on with the actual perpetrators?
As far as I understand, the Saudi authorities claim to have arrested 18 individuals involved in the plot. I haven't seen an exact list of the specific 18, but my understanding is that the 15 people who were involved in the kind of two teams that came to Istanbul and a few other officials who involved in some of the decision making, possibly the consul general. I'm actually not sure about that.
Yeah.
But I believe it actually does not include the consul general at the current stage. They're under arrest, according to Saudi authorities. We don't know what that entails, whether they've been just put under house detention, whether they've been pulled into a facility. And the Turkish government has suggested that they would be willing to try them if they were returned to Turkey. I think they've kind of not pushed the point. They've said we would be welcome the opportunity to prosecute them. They haven't quite demanded it or made it a bilateral issue yet, but they have said they're willing to pursue prosecution against these people if it's returned to Turkey. At this point, we're still waiting to see what will come out of these negotiations that are happening between Turkey and Saudi Arabia in the context of the broader international community, who's kind of weighing in with all parties on this, to see exactly what avenue towards accountability it kind of comes forward. At this point, we just don't know.
We only have another minute or so, and I think it will be interesting to see what develops as we move forward. And thank you for putting that into perspective. Last question here. How is this going to affect the stability or instability of the region, the relationships? You know, you have Israel involved, Egypt involved, obviously Turkey, Saudi Arabia, U.S. How is this murder going to affect, and I don't expect you have the answer, but what perspective can we look at?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, MBS had played a central role in this kind of emerging coalition that had a vision for what the Middle East would be moving towards. And this involves the Netanyahu government in Israel. It involves the Sisi government in Egypt, both of whom have kind of weighed in with President Trump in regards to encourage him to continue support for MBS. It does involve President Trump and Jared Kushner, who have kind of coordinated closely with MBS on a variety of policy issues. It's really focused on taking extremely hardline stance against Iran, up to and including continued support for the war in Yemen. That's kind of led by the Saudi Arabian military. And then other elements in a few other places as well. The Palestinian peace plan may be a part of this that the Trump administration has been talking about for a while. A few other elements that are really intended to kind of solidify this anti-Iranian front in the Middle East. There is a good chance that by undermining and weakening MBS, this confrontation is going to make all those policies and particularly Saudi Arabia's central role in them. And it really did play a central, particularly kind of bankroll role in them. Really fall out. And I think you're going to see some cracks in those policies, at least what some people aspire them to be moving forward. I think they're going to have to stop short of that goal.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it all fares out as we move forward, because I think you're right. I think that you can't help but look at those cracks and see, you know, whether MBS is going to have that kind of power or authority or influence in some of these other countries, which I think they had kind of bet and counted on him for having. So, you know, we appreciate it. You've really broken it down pretty well here, Scott. We appreciate all your comments. Scott Anderson's David Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings. All the best with that. And hopefully we can have you back on as things continue and pursue these issues. It's just a really complex and sensitive subject matter. Thanks for being
Absolutely.
With us today.
Thanks
Scott.
For having me.
All right, take care. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have Mary Holland on. She's the director of Graduate Legal Skills Program at the New York University School of Law, and we're going to talk about vaccinations after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Talk Radio 790 KABC News Update. I'm Steve Cumming. Some 900 firefighters are working to save residential areas in Los Angeles and Ventura counties where the Woolsey Fire has burned 75,000 acres. Thousand Oaks City Council member Claudia Bill de la Peña says the past few days have been brutal, but she insists the city is in good hands.
I know that firefighters have slept in the streets overnight to keep an eye on fires, embers, making sure that there are no additional homes burning.
Officials are reporting two fatalities today near Mulholland Highway in Los Angeles, adding to 9 deaths related to the campfire in Northern California, which is now 20% contained. Fire officials are urging residents to heed evacuation warnings. Nearly 100,000 people are out of their homes in Ventura County, and significant structural damage is being reported. KABC SoCal weather, sunny and smoky at times today with highs in the mid-70s to lower 80s. More news coming up in 30 minutes, fire news every 15 minutes. Continuing coverage at KABC.com. I'm Steve Cumming, Talk Radio 790, KABC News.
Wendy's knows when it comes to fries, the more the better. Because people just can't get enough of their favorite hamburger sidekick. So for a limited time, Wendy's is giving you any size fry for just a dollar. That's a small, medium, even a large order of natural cut sea salted goodness for just any size you like for the same.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. Is that Bronski beat? Oh, yeah, I like it. I like it. What a surprise. Surprise. Carrie Kasem is on the line live from Florida. Helping clean up the mess of Hurricane Michael. Thank you for doing such wonderful work, Carrie, and thanks for calling in.
Thanks. I'm just glad I have reception. We actually have to pick up some more volunteers at the airport, so I have reception and I could call in. It's a mess down here. You know, Panama City, Callaway City, Mexico Beach is completely destroyed. 90% of the homes have damage or are completely destroyed in Callaway City. Same with Panama City. It's absolutely horrible. And it is a few weeks after the hurricane, and it seems like, you know, they feel like they don't want to be forgotten. And there's a lot of disaster relief groups down here still, but they need a lot of help. So, you know, if anybody wants to join and come down and help, my organization will pay for everything. The plane tickets, food accommodations, everything. You just have to be here for 2 weeks or more.
How do they get a hold of you or the organization to help?
Most people just get a hold of me on social media. So you can do it on Instagram or you can do it on Facebook, Twitter. I'm just the Carrie Kasem, KerriKasem. And if you're serious, I'll put you in touch with the people who will get you down here. And we've had actually quite a lot of people from my social media come down and join the group. And it's been amazing. There was this one woman, Alan, you would have just, it was heartbreaking. She walked into one of the stores that was open. There's not very many. And she's just crying and crying. And we sat with her, and this woman had lost her house, completely gone. And she had lost her entire business.
Wow.
Flattened.
Wow.
Nothing left. She was living in her car. And it's just hopeless, you know?
It's horrible.
And FEMA's doing everything they can, but there's so many people in need. It's, you know, there's a line. So a lot of people are just waiting and waiting and waiting.
Yeah.
We were, just, yeah.
You
go
know,
ahead.
The time goes by and people don't realize that, you know, we shouldn't be forgetting, you know, things are still in dire straits, and people are needing so much this assistance and help. And, you know, it's not something that just gets fixed in 2 seconds, and especially when it involves your life and your and everything is turned upside down and you don't have work or home or anything.
No, there's people living in tents all around the city. You see these, you know, tent cities pop up, and there's people, we would go into the Waffle House to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
It's crazy. The Waffle Houses are some of the only buildings standing, which I don't understand. I mean, yes, they're cement, but they're full of windows and they're all fine. But you see people in there at a table or at a chair, and they're sleeping. You know, it's so sad.
Yeah.
And we were at a big cat sanctuary where it's called Bear Creek Feline Center. And these people, all volunteers, nobody takes a dime. They rescue big cats, cats who have, they're unfortunately like people buy them young and then they don't want them when they get older. And they're going to put them down and they go rescue them. Or they, the cats have spinal bifida or 3 legs, cats that would be put down, cats that have been really abused. And there's no breeding at all. They just let them have a safe place to live for the rest of their lives. And they run off, you know, all donations. So I have a bunch. If you go to my Facebook or my Instagram or Twitter, you'll see I've put up links to their GoFundMe. So, I mean, they have lost everything. The fence alone at the cat place, thank God, they only lost one cat, and that was due to stress after the storm. But they've lost, I mean, like the cages need repairing. The entire fence is down. Sorry about the airport. We're waiting on
people.
Yeah,
it's all right.
Now.
It's all right. Well, you know, Carrie, keep up the good work, because, you know, a lot of people can't be there, and you're representing a lot of people who are trying to help out. And, you know, I know you'll be there a little bit, and hopefully you can, and your all the other workers can have an impact. We were waiting for Mary Holland to call in, and I had promoed Mary Holland in the first half hour. She's the director of Graduate Legal Skills Program at New York University School of Law, and she wrote a book along with Kim Mack Rosenberg and Eileen Iorio, called The HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. And it looks like we've been betrayed, because Mary has ghosted us. Supposed to be on. We've booked her. And thanks, Genevieve Wong, for booking her. But apparently, we can't get a hold of Mary. So I don't know, Carrie, if you have any experience with the HPV vaccine. You know, it's interesting. It's the human papillomavirus vaccine. And it's been very, very controversial. I know that in the book, HPV Vaccine on Trial, Mary Holland talks about it being big business, $2.5 billion in annual sales. And I think she questions the legitimacy, notwithstanding the fact that recently the HPV vaccine has expanded for people ages 27 to 45. Originally, mm-hmm. it had come out, it was for teenagers, you know, who could avoid sexually transmitted diseases and cervical cancer and others, that it purportedly, genital warts, that it purportedly would prevent. Again, I think that Mary is of the opinion that it's not as effective as the world is supposed to think it is.
And I don't think it's an opinion when you have so many HPV vaccine-related illnesses, sicknesses, and deaths. And there's been so many of them reported across the world, in Japan, in Australia, of course here, but I always follow the money trail. And you look, you know, it's like, well, they're making $2.5 billion, right? They're going to continue to market it. And if they can market it to people, even though it might not be very useful, they're going to do that. And, you know, if somebody's going to take a vaccine, they should know how many people have died from it,
yeah,
how many people it affects, and the percentages. And then you have the right to make an informed decision about any vaccine. But the fact that they're giving this to kids and it's killing them and making them sick, and I don't know how many have died, so I cannot give that stat right now.
Well, Mary has said, and not on our show because she's not here, but if she were, I did see that she said that one out, and I don't know if this is true or not. I mean, a lot of people say fact check, but one out of 500 have become seriously injured. And, you know, one out of 500, that those odds, I wouldn't play those odds. I mean, yeah, odds are, I guess, that you'll be okay. But 500, one in 500, that's a lot of serious injuries, if that's really the case.
It's a scary fact, if that is the truth, and a scary stat, if that is the truth. So, and you see this with other vaccines as well, but we're getting side effects, you know, like they do tell you the side effects, but they don't tell you the stats on how many people have them. And I think that's wrong. I think that's definitely something that needs to be changed up at the Capitol or in Washington. You should know your stats, how many people have died. But the problem is a lot of these people don't speak out, because if they do, they don't get the payment from the vaccine company. So their kid is injured or their kid has died. They will pay you a very nice sum of money.
Yeah.
More than you would get probably if you were to sue them. So they don't say anything. So you're not hearing about these, you know, vaccine injuries and deaths. And I'm not saying all vaccines are bad. I'm just saying we should know the stats, the real stats, and that should be law.
You know, recently when they expanded it to ages 27 to 45, they said that the vaccination in women showed a lot of success in preventing persistent HPV infection, genital warts, vulvar and vaginal precancers, cervical precancers, and cervical cancers related to the virus types covered by the vaccine. Again, you know, we have to look at the information. In men, they said that it was effective in younger men in creating immunity and helped with a lot of prevention. The question, Carrie, is, and if Mary was here, we'd ask her, if that's true, then maybe this vaccine is really worth something, notwithstanding the big business that you talk about.
Yeah, I don't know. But when a vaccine has been, I mean, consistently in the news about the injury and death, there's a problem. There's a problem. And I don't know the stats, so I can't give them out. And this is, at this point, my opinion and what I've been hearing. But I think it just makes sense and common sense to know the stats on something you're putting in your body. You know, if one out of 100 people are going to be injured or die from it, I want to know that. If one out of 1,000,
yeah,
one out of 10,000, wouldn't want to know that?
And you really don't know what kind of success it's going to have, because you're looking up into the future. All we do know is that pharmaceutical companies are making a lot of money, and businesses as well.
You know, our friend Simon Conway said something to me. You know, he's the talk radio host up in Iowa who's been on the show, and you've been on his show several times. So he said, you know, something really hit me hard when I knew that there were no cases of measles in Iowa, and they had stated that fact, that there were no cases of measles. Then the CDC came in and they lobbied for it, and everybody had to get their measles shots. And he thought, it took him, you know, it kind of woke him up. He said, that's wrong, and that's very interesting how that would happen. Nobody had measles in his state.
Carrie,
The CDC stated that there were no measles. The pharma companies came in and lobbied so that everybody would have to get a measles shot.
You know, we just located Mary Holland, so we're happy to welcome her. Carrie, thanks for all of this information. You seem to be an expert, and I don't know that Mary would really disagree with a lot. You've said she didn't hear you, but I want to welcome her to Gervie's Law. I know we had a little bit of difficulty, Mary, in getting a hold of you. She's the director of Graduate Legal Skills Program at New York University School of Law. The book that has come out recently, The HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. It's Mary Holland, Kim Mack Rosenberg, and Eileen Iorio. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so you didn't hear what Carrie was saying, but we were talking about, we were debating the efficacy of the vaccine versus the potential injuries and deaths that may be associated. Now, I heard somewhere I think you said 1 in 500 people may be affected. Whether that's true or not, that ratio is really not great when you think about the potential efficacy of the vaccine. Is that number a real number?
So I have mentioned 1 in 500 as the rate of estimated serious adverse events from the human papillomavirus vaccine. And that's the number that Dr. Jesper Nielsen, who was a doctor in Denmark involved in the clinical trials and then the head of an injury center for young women with injuries from the vaccine, that's the number that he gives. And it doesn't sound like so many, but for a permanent debilitating injury, that's a really high rate for a vaccine for which the people who are getting it, the preteenagers, they're not at any risk of the cancers that it might protect against.
So your position in the book is a lot of people are making a lot of money off the vaccine, and perhaps there can be a lot of serious injuries avoided given the potential efficacy of it.
Well, with the book, The HPV Vaccine on Trial, it really takes the story of the vaccine from its invention stage through what's been happening since it hit the market in 2006. And we're just trying to give the whole story. Basically what the regulators are saying and physicians are saying, it's all good. It's all good. There's no downside. There's no safety issues. But that's not what the full record shows. So we believe in informed consent, and we want people to make up their own minds. We think there were fatal flaws in the clinical trials for this, for the vaccine, for the HPV vaccine, and that there's no question that it's causing real harm in a select group of individuals.
How are people supposed to, Carrie, you can jump in a second. I just want a quick question here for Mary. How are people supposed to make up their own mind when a lot of them don't have the information or don't have the ability? And I want to just, because we don't have that much time, but I want to bring in vaccinations for kids and California Senate Bill 277. A lot of people, for personal reasons, back in the day said no vaccines. And then the school system said, the legislature said, if you're going to school, you're going to get the vaccine. So can we equate the two where people are trying to use their own personal opinions versus what they should do, or in this case in California, what they're now prescribed to do for kids?
Well, I really believe that informed consent means you have to get information and you have to have a choice. You have to be able to refuse something to be able to consent to something. And I think people have to work with their healthcare providers to make that decision. I don't believe that the state should be making a medical decision for every individual. I really think that people, there's bioindividuality. I don't think SB 277 was really necessary. I think that it does conflict with the constitutional right that children have in California to attend school. That's a clear Supreme Court California decision under Serrano v. Priest. So my view is that that statute is not in the best interest of children and violates their right, that children who aren't vaccinated, who are non-infectious, healthy children, they're being discriminated against.
What about people? I know you agree, Carrie, but I just have to say, what about people who say they don't want their kids in a same school environment with kids that have not been vaccinated?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, people can say that. I don't think that they're 100% protected from disease just because they now don't have children who are in full compliance with the 10 vaccines that SB 277 requires. Those kids are still going to the mall. They're still playing baseball. They're still going to church. They're still in the movie theaters. And, you know, we know that even in 100% vaccinated populations, people can still get the measles. life has risks. I think it's an irrational idea to think that everybody is better off simply because children who aren't fully in compliance can't go to school. It just doesn't comport with reality. But there's a lot of money to be made, and there's a lot of sort of public obedience, and it sort of goes along with some ideas that, you know, all vaccines are good, and anybody who questions them is cuckoo.
Carrie?
And that's what it has felt, because I was up in Sacramento and I saw the lines of people, hundreds and hundreds of people waiting to talk about the fact that the law that was being passed, where, you know, required children to have these vaccines, was unconstitutional. I mean, and there were so many people. Did the news cover that? No. Did everybody get to speak? No. It was not covered. We did not get enough media to show that. And it's not people who are anti-vaccination or anti-vaxxers. Right. It was people who were necessarily, like, not necessarily against it, but thinking this is, you know, you have the right to put what you want in your own body and your child's body.
Exactly.
Before you got on, I was talking to Alan about the fact that there should be a law requiring the statistics of people who get sick, people who die, people who are, you know, injured from vaccines. And there should be the stats, just like you post how many side effects there are. There should be the statistics as well.
Wow.
And it should change as the statistics grow.
You know, Carrie, it's interesting because they do publish the statistics saying how many people haven't been vaccinated or how many people are not in full compliance, but they don't really publicize information about vaccine injuries. That is really the real rate of vaccine injury is really not clear. It's not tracked appropriately.
Well, I think the most important thing that we can all consider here is information and getting as much information as possible. And I know a lot of medical people have opinions and would vouch for vaccines. And then, of course, you have the other position, which Mary, I think, has articulated well about putting something in your body that, you know, isn't mandatory, isn't and should be voluntary. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. We were trying to get hold of you earlier, Mary, but importantly, you have indicated, at least we meshed the two together. We talked about the book. It's called The HBV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. How can people get a hold of that so they can learn and read more about it?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, it's available. Thank you so much. Sorry you had trouble reaching me.
That's okay. We appreciate your comments. And Carrie, good luck with all the disaster relief. You're doing great work in Florida now, and I'll look forward to seeing you back in the studio when you're back.
Thank you, and thank you, Mary, so much.
All right, thanks for listening today. You're listening next week, same time. You better be listening. Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.